Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for Thursday, October 17th's reading of the Christian Science Monitor Daily. My name is Shari McCundan. Today I'll be reading premium stories from Wednesday, October 16th, and following up with miscellaneous articles. In this issue, for SpaceX, ambitions in the sky create tensions on Earth. Drones find cracks in Israel's high-tech air defenses. States get bolder about banning legacy admissions. How AI deepfakes test voter confidence, election integrity. This artist turned a journey of forgiveness into a film. Today's intro by Mark Sappenfield, editor. Amid upheaval, the possibility of restoration. Amid the everyday awfulness of the Middle East and a contentious election in the United States, how do we care for our soul? Troubled by anger and uncertainty, we can feel bruised in ways beyond what others can see, existentially disturbed. But Stephen Humphrey's article today points to the possibility of restoration. The journey of a brilliant young director struggling with trauma is more than a story about a film, but a study of one path to healing. For that reason, I believe it is as important as anything you will read today. For SpaceX, ambitions in the sky create tensions on Earth. As SpaceX transforms the Gulf Coast towns near its Starbase launch site, Texas is fast becoming the capital of the private space industry. For locals, the excitement and innovation blend with concerns for the area's unique ecosystem. By Henry Gass, staff writer, Boca Chica, Texas. Charter fisher Cliff Fleming has spent most of his adult life here on the southern tip of Texas, making his living off the area's abundant natural resources. But now he has a lucrative side business, taking tourists out for fishing and a clear view of SpaceX rocket launches. He calls it a blast and cast. Having a space company next door hasn't exactly been smooth sailing. Last April, a cloud of concrete dust blanketed his boat, a result of a post-launch rapid unscheduled disassembly. In laypeople's terms, an explosion. Still, Captain Fleming says that he loves having SpaceX as a neighbor. On Sunday, the private space company owned by billionaire Elon Musk conducted the latest flight test of its Starship rocket here in Boca Chica. For some residents like Captain Fleming, there has never been a more exciting time to live here. SpaceX is now seeking permission, starting next year, to conduct up to 25 launches and landings of the Starship Super Heavy, a mammoth rocket system designed to reach Mars. But the company's plans have been disrupted by a series of lawsuits and regulatory issues, particularly around potential environmental damage. Starbase is surrounded by a protected wildlife habitat that attracts hundreds of million dollars annually in ecotourism as a popular waypoint for migratory birds and home to dolphins, pelicans, and endangered sea turtles. The test on Sunday included the milestone achievement of safely returning the Super Heavy rocket to the launch pad. It had been repeatedly delayed due to a variety of lawsuits by environmental groups and others against the company, claiming that launches have spilled toxic wastewater into nearby waterways. Still, while some voice concerns about what a more active SpaceX presence could mean for local communities, objections are largely eclipsed by the excitement about the company's potential. Residents living in Starbase's shadow say they feel like they're in the middle of something incredible and the start of something historic. Private companies like SpaceX are becoming integral to space exploration, they say, and this area, and Texas as a whole, could become central to the growing commercial space industry. I'm just a small part of that, but everybody benefits from it, says Captain Fleming. Maybe it's a long-term problem, he adds, referring to the potential environmental damages, but everybody benefits when those things take off. 10 years after setting up at the end of Highway 4 in Boca Chica. SpaceX is visible everywhere you look in coastal towns near the border city of Brownsville, Texas. Miniature metal starships stand outside stores on South Padre Island. At Port Isabel restaurant, you can order an Occupy Mars omelet. The local school district changed its mascot last year to the Rockets. But along with the enthusiasm has come doubt, especially among residents concerned about collateral damage caused by this immense scientific endeavor. Clouds of dust and grime settled over Port Isabel after two previous Starship launches. A 2022 rocket engine test sparked a 68-acre fire in a neighboring wildlife refuge, home to nesting white-winged doves, egrets, and the threatened snowy plover. There are also worries that a water deluge system under the launch pad, which sprays over 200,000 gallons of water during a launch to suppress the heat and noise of the Super Heavy booster's 33 engines, is polluting waterways used by native turtles and dolphins, as well as fish that people catch and eat. Critics also argue that the spaceship rocket with its Super Heavy booster has never, in fact, been properly permitted. When the U.S. Federal Aviation Administration, FAA, first approved the Starbase site in 2013, it studied potential environmental impacts from launches of the Falcon 9 and the Falcon Heavy rockets and a variety of reusable suborbital launch vehicles. Then, in 2018, Mr. Musk announced that the site would be dedicated to launches of the much larger Starship. Big enough for a Falcon 9 to fit inside it, the Starship is the most powerful rocket ever built. Yet, the FAA hasn't completed an environmental impact statement since 2013, agreeing with SpaceX that shorter and more limited assessments before each launch test are sufficient. But since the agency required a more in-depth study of the potential impacts of launching the 1,566-ton Falcon Heavy rocket, critics say they should do the same for the more than 4,000-ton Starship Super Heavy. Every Starship launch represents a rocket being fired here that was never, ever meant to be fired here and has not been assessed to be fired here, says Ken Saxon, a board member of Save RGV, an environmental group opposing industrial development in the Rio Grande Valley. This is particularly important, critics add, when SpaceX keeps adding new features to its launches. The water deluge system only came in last year, and the fifth Starship launch tested, for the first time, the launch tower's ability to catch the Super Heavy as the booster returned to Earth 7 minutes after launch. Critical to making the Starship system reusable and efficient, the catch maneuver raises new potential regulatory questions, including the effects of deceleration engine burns and sonic booms, thunder-like noises created when an object travels through air faster than the speed of sound. In mid-August, the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality sanctioned the company over its water deluge system. The commission's case alleged that thousands of gallons of water runoff from the system, containing pollutants like cyanide, copper, and chromium, have spilled into sensitive local waterways, according to government documents obtained by NPR. Months earlier, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency had told the company the same system was operating in violation of federal law. There are also at least five ongoing lawsuits against SpaceX operations in Boca Chica. Meanwhile, the company just filed its own lawsuit against California, accusing a state agency of being opposed to Mr. Musk's politics rather than having substantive reasons for rejecting an increase in launches there. Federal regulators, for their part, say the company's desire for fast-paced testing and design changes makes it difficult for them to evaluate potential impacts and issue new permits. Nevertheless, the FAA sped up its processes to ensure the fifth Starship test could go ahead on Sunday in Texas. It's still unclear, however, if the agency will approve up to 25 launches and landings in the state starting next year. Frequent tests and design changes are central to the company's philosophy. And with NASA hoping to use Starship as part of its mission to return humans to the moon in 2026, the company needs to perfect the system as soon as possible. SpaceX did not respond to multiple requests for comments, but in a lengthy statement released in September, the company said it has always had government permission to continue operating. The two agencies' actions are entirely tied to disagreements over paperwork, the company said. The narrative that we operate free of or in defiance of environmental regulation is demonstrably false. The delays are as frustrating for some locals, even those who've had disputes with the company, as they are for the company. Maria Poynter retired here with her husband in 2015. Moving into the last house at the end of Highway 4, the Alaskan native fell in love with what she calls her wilderness. Then SpaceX moved in next door, and within a few years, the company started expanding and wanted their property. In 2020, after some reportedly tense negotiations, SpaceX bought out the Poynters. They still live in the area, and Mrs. Poynter has built a popular YouTube channel documenting rocket tests. While it was challenging, she believes their move will be for the greater good. It saddens me to think so many people can't be happy for the future that's coming, she says. If we're going to hold back the space industry, we're going to hold back the world. Indeed, commercial space companies are becoming central to a modern-day space race. As it's become cheaper to build and launch satellites, it's become more profitable selling satellite and data services that come with launching things into orbit. As a result, private companies like SpaceX, Boeing, and Blue Origin, created by Amazon founder Jeff Bezos, are finding new and innovative ways to access low Earth orbit, a region just above the planet's atmosphere. SpaceX and Boeing have contracted with NASA since 2014 to shuttle crews to the International Space Station. Mr. Musk's company is also helping the agency with its Artemis program to return humans to the moon and is developing a spacecraft to deorbit and thus decommission the space station. At least a half dozen private companies plan to launch their own space stations in the coming decades. The space industry is projected to be worth $1.8 trillion by 2035, according to the World Economic Forum. Companies are thinking not just about the services they could provide, like deploying satellites and shuttling crews to and from Earth. They also see long-term profit in space tourism, research, and manufacturing in low Earth orbit and asteroid mining, among other possibilities. Issues remain, as evidenced by Boeing's Starliner stranding two astronauts on the space station this year. But the private sector is on the right track, according to Scott Pace, director of the Space Policy Institute at the George Washington University Elliott School of International Affairs. They're innovating and working fast in a way you haven't seen since the early days of Apollo, says Dr. Pace. Going deeper into space, operating on the lunar surface and beyond are the next stages. Texas wants to be at the forefront of this private sector boom. The Lone Star State has been a leading player in U.S. spaceflight for decades, and it has nurtured the growing private space industry as well. Starbase is one of four spaceports in the state. Only Florida, with six, has more, and is home to 18 of the 20 largest aerospace manufacturing companies in the world, according to Texas 2036, a nonpartisan public policy think tank. Earlier this year, the state legislature established the Texas Space Commission to boost the state's commercial space industry. One hope is that it will benefit poor, isolated communities like Boca Chica, many of which have seen populations decline and poverty increase over the past decade. Spaceflight by necessity operates in remote areas. The Blue Origin spaceport, for example, is in Van Horn, a West Texas town with about 2,000 people, just larger than the staff of an Amazon fulfillment center. While SpaceX has brought more jobs to surrounding Cameron County, locals say many new workers have come in from elsewhere. Fewer than one in four residents have a bachelor's degree or higher, according to Census Bureau data. I would like to see the Valley be more than just a tourist destination, says Teviot Creighton, a professor at the University of Texas, Rio Grande Valley, in nearby Brownsville. Being the next major technological innovation region is what we aspire to. That's the dream. Driving down Highway 4, Mr. Saxon points out lomas, small hills of brush and trees that form over centuries in wetlands off the side of the road. This stretch of road is one of only three places in the world where lomas can still be found. Other rare sightings here include migratory birds and sea turtles' nests. While launching rockets is exciting and the possibility of human travel to Mars may inspire, the unique ecosystem in this corner of South Texas is just as captivating, he says. It's a flaw that we have not got people interested in what this nature offers them, he says. People are taking pleasure in SpaceX, but all of that is in nature a million times over. Some supporters believe that SpaceX's growth here can coexist with the unique ecosystem. They point to another launch site, Cape Canaveral, on Florida's Atlantic coast. The NASA-operated complex is the most active spaceport in the United States, and it borders the Merritt Island National Wildlife Refuge. Establishing along with the Space Center in the early 1960s, the Wildlife Refuge hosts over 1,500 species of plants and animals, including 15 threatened and endangered species. In some sense, having SpaceX anchored there actually provides some protection, says Dr. Creighton of the Texas Hub. No one else is going to build a subdivision or a factory within a few miles of a launch site. There are also the intangible benefits of space travel to consider. The Apollo missions inspired a generation to believe it could touch the stars. As profitable as the private space industry may become, the transcendent appeal of cosmos may be its most valuable asset. No one's thinking about partisan politics or polarization when a starship lifts off, says Dr. Pace. Space is something that can unite people, bring us together. It's something to feel positive about, and I think we need that. Editor's note, this article was updated on October 16th to add a sentence on a new lawsuit over SpaceX launch plans in California. Drones find cracks in Israel's high-tech air defenses. Warfare requires constant adaptation, both offensive and defensive, in tactics and technology. Often the trend lines in innovation point to modern sophistication, but sometimes older and simpler methods are the most effective. By Dina Kraft, Special Correspondent, Tel Aviv, Israel. Israel's multi-layered missile defense system, which has been adept at intercepting many of the rockets and missiles fired at population centers throughout this multi-front war, is facing a new threat. Nimble, slower, and often small drones. No air raid sirens blared in Israel Sunday when a drone launched by Hezbollah forces in Lebanon entered Israeli airspace, eventually crashing through the roof of an army-based dining hall deep inside the country. The explosion killed four recruits having dinner after a day of training and wounded dozens of others, some of them seriously. The drones are one of the biggest challenges facing us in the past year, says Zvika Haimovitz, a retired brigadier general and former commander of Israel's Air Defense Corps. We are dealing with multi-directional threat, and the Iranian proxies recognize the potential and the gaps in Israeli defenses, he adds. Sunday's fatal drone, one of three launched simultaneously by Hezbollah, was originally detected and then lost for 30 minutes, during which it flew roughly 60 miles until its GPS-driven warhead hit its target. The other two were intercepted, one by Israel's vaunted Iron Dome air defense system and the other by the Navy. Friday night on Yom Kippur, the holiest day in the Jewish year, a Hezbollah drone struck a building in Herzliya in central Israel, but air raid sirens had alerted people to seek shelter and there were no injuries. In July, the Houthi militia in Yemen, like Hezbollah, a member of the Iran-funded and cultivated Axis of Resistance, fired a drone that flew hundreds of miles before hitting an apartment building in Tel Aviv, killing a man sleeping in his bed. Drones have also been fired into Israel by Iran-backed Shiite militias in Iraq and during the first ever direct Iranian attack on Israel in April. Their region is currently bracing for Israel's response to a ballistic missile barrage from Iran in late September, and in turn, a possible counterstrike from Iran. The retaliatory cycle could potentially plunge the Middle East even further into chaos. On Tuesday, the U.S. Department of Defense confirmed the Terminal High Altitude Area Defense System had arrived in Israel, as had the U.S. soldiers who will be operating it in the event of a ballistic missile attack by Iran. Underscoring the urgency of such assistance, a report in the British newspaper, The Financial Times, said Israel's missile defenses are short of interceptors. Touring the army base south of Haifa that was hit Sunday, Defense Minister Yoav Gallant told the soldiers Monday that the military was investigating what went wrong and was developing new methods to address the drone threat. Daniel Hagari, the army spokesperson, was more blunt on Sunday. We must bring a better defense. Mr. Haimovitz notes that over 1,200 drones have been launched toward Israel since Hamas invaded southern Israel a year ago. Most were identified and intercepted, but 221 slipped through. It will never be a 100% success, but we need to fill the gaps and do much better than an 82% success rate, he says. Why are they such a wily weapon? The challenges that drones pose are many, although they are a relatively low-tech weapon. First, they are slower and smaller and fly lower than missiles, making it harder for radar systems to detect them. They can easily be confused with Israeli planes or even birds. They are built to be light and often under radar-absorbing carbon materials instead of radar-reflecting metal. They're also very maneuverable, able to perform complex and sharp movements in the air and go up and down and below the sight of detection systems, says Yehoshua Kaliski, a senior researcher at the Institute of National Security Studies. One of the complexities of Israel's defense mission is to build a picture of what one is really seeing in the sky, Mr. Haimovitz says. We're talking about a chaotic picture with a lot of objects and targets to decipher. Helicopters, jets, interceptors, enemy rockets, and birds. And in real time, you need to build situational awareness in a very busy picture. Intercepting a drone can also be tricky, Dr. Kaliski says, because fighter planes fly 4 times faster than drones, and because drones launched into Israel from as close as Lebanon have little time for interception. In recent years, Israel prioritized developing air defense systems, including the Iron Dome, David's Sling, and the Arrow 3 missiles, rather than defenses against low-flying aircraft and drones. Another vulnerability? The airbase targeted and hit by Hezbollah Sunday, and the details about it, including its dining hall, were easy to find online. Among the new tier of systems Israel is working on that could boost its drone defenses is a powerful laser being developed by Rafael Advanced Defense Systems, an arms manufacturer owned by Israel's Ministry of Defense. Another solution being touted is more old-fashioned, a modern version of the Gatling gun called the M61 Vulcan, which was developed decades ago. It can shoot 6,000 rounds per minute and is radar-guided. We have to have a new outlook in the battlefield and accept the fact that our enemies are using relatively low-tech weapons in an effort to defeat us, says Dr. Kaliski. So, we may have to look back and adopt old methods. States get bolder about banning legacy admissions. In legislatures and on college campuses across the United States, the issue of giving admissions preferences to relatives of alumni or donors is heating up. California's ban on the practice is further fueling a nationwide debate about how to create an even playing field for applicants. By Ira Porter, staff writer. Should college applicants get preferential treatment if they're related to wealthy alumni or donors? States are increasingly saying no, with California being the 5th and largest to do so on September 30th. Public schools in that state had dropped the practice decades earlier. The new law bars it at private nonprofit colleges and universities. The Golden State joins Illinois, Maryland, Virginia, and Colorado, all of which have done away with legacy admissions at either all schools or at public institutions. Massachusetts and other states are considering similar action, and members of Congress have also embraced the idea. For some institutions, it could mean the loss of a consistent revenue source, and some argue an important part of school culture and community. But opponents say the recent laws go a long way to support equal access to education. "This is terrific news," says James Murphy, Director of Career Pathways and Post-Secondary Policy at the nonprofit Education Reform Now. "Not only because it's California, and that's a big and influential state, but also because it's only the second state to abandon legacies in private universities." The push to ban legacy admissions became more public after the 2023 U.S. Supreme Court decision that did away with affirmative action, deeming it unconstitutional to consider race in admissions. In that decision, the High Court also commented on other practices. "Legacy admissions, while race neutral on their face," wrote Justice Neil Gorsuch in his concurring opinion, "undoubtedly benefit white and wealthy applicants the most." State bans are fairly recent. Colorado was the first to bar legacy admissions at public schools in 2021. Earlier this year, Maryland Governor Wes Moore made his state the first to include private, nonprofit colleges and universities, as well as their public counterparts, in a ban. This year, Illinois and Virginia also passed laws banning legacy admissions at public institutions. After the Supreme Court's affirmative action decision, advocacy groups filed a complaint with the U.S. Department of Education, asking for an investigation into legacy admissions at schools like Harvard. The University of Pennsylvania is currently being investigated in a separate complaint. A 2019 study showed that 43% of white students admitted to Harvard were legacies, athletes, or children of parents or relatives who donated to the university. It also showed that 70% of the school's legacy students were white. As the organization that filed the federal civil rights complaint against Harvard University for its discrimination, legacy, and donor preferences, we applaud California's move, and we ask, why is Massachusetts lagging behind on this critical civil rights issue? Says Yvonne Espinoza Madrigal, Executive Director at Lawyers for Civil Rights Boston, in a statement after California's decision. Mr. Espinoza Madrigal called legacy admission an unfair and undeserved preference that is harmful to applicants of color. Along with members of Congress, the U.S. Department of Education, and President Joe Biden have called out the practice, with Mr. Biden saying that it expands privilege instead of opportunity. 2/3 of Americans say legacy should not be considered in college admissions, up from 68% in 2019, according to a 2022 Pew Research Center survey. Last week, Brown University's student paper, the Brown Daily Herald, released the results of a poll in which nearly 60% of student respondents said they somewhat or strongly opposed legacy admissions. The Ivy League school is considering whether it will continue the practice. Of the students who enrolled in the class of 2027, for example, 8% are legacies, according to Brown. Some 460 private, nonprofit, four-year institutions reported that they do consider legacy admissions in a survey released last year by the National Center for Education Statistics. If it does do away with the practice, Brown will join the selective schools who don't use it, including Johns Hopkins University, Amherst College, and the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. The California law will affect schools such as Stanford University, the University of Southern California, and Santa Clara University, all places where legacy admissions have accounted for double-digit percentages of admitted students. In California, everyone should be able to get ahead through merit, skill, and hard work. The California dream shouldn't be accessible to just a lucky few, which is why we're opening the door to higher education wide enough for everyone, fairly, Governor Gavin Newsom said in a statement. The new legislation will not take effect until next September. Starting in 2026, all private schools in the state must submit an annual report to show that they are following the law. Schools that violate the law will appear on a published list by the California Department of Justice and they will also have to disclose the overall number and certain information about legacy students who were admitted. Private schools get federal and state dollars for research, financial aid, and tax exemptions, which means that the state and federal governments can ask them to comply with laws. So far, the University of Southern California has said it will follow the law. Stanford has said that it will continue to review its admissions policies. Elite schools, including Harvard, have argued that the practice helps build community and that it is part of their fundraising process. A committee at Brown looked at admissions practices, wrote in a report released in February that it is considering whether it is fair to end legacy preferences at the moment when the applicant pool is beginning to reflect the more diverse population of Brown alumni and alumnae, many of whom attended the university at a time when it was less inclusive and welcoming. But the group's report also noted that removing legacy preferences could lead to somewhat more diversity in the group of admitted students. That's the bottom line, says Stanford Law School professor Ralph Richard Banks. Legacy admissions are unfair in the sense that you're giving one student an advantage over another because of who their parent is. That's not the way things work in the United States of America, but it's also the case that the universities have developed a business model that relies on that sort of preference. That's what drives the fundraising. Mr. Banks says he doesn't know if legacy admissions bans will curtail a significant portion of those donations, but that the schools don't want to find out. It's important to say that it's possible that these institutions might lose some donations, says Mr. Murphy from Education Reform Now. But he adds, most people that give donations to colleges give very small amounts, and if a college can only get money from their alumni by essentially setting up a quid pro quo, you send us money, we'll help your kid out, that's a pretty bad sign for how that college has built community. Universities have spent money to defend their positions by lobbying behind closed doors, Mr. Banks says. The California law, for example, initially called for schools to be fined if they violated the law, which saw backlash from some lawmakers and schools. But when that language was taken out, it received bipartisan approval. He thinks that that will be the case with schools nationally. Even so, some are still hoping the tides have turned. I firmly believe that in like 5, maybe 10 years, people are going to be like, oh my God, can you believe that colleges used to have legacy preferences? Says Mr. Murphy. He adds that though the practice is nowhere near as heinous, he equates legacy admissions to people having segregated pools in the country. It's embarrassing that anybody ever thought that was okay. This artist turned a journey of forgiveness into a film. As his new movie debuts, artist Titus Kaphar reflects on what it takes to arrive at forgiveness and to share it with the world. By Stephen Humphries, staff writer. It took a phone call with Steven Spielberg to reassure Titus Kaphar that he was okay. While directing a scene in his debut movie, Mr. Kaphar had endured a breakdown. I literally said cut and started sobbing, he recalls. I had to leave the set, locked myself in a dark room, and just lay there on the floor crying, letting these waves of heaving tears just roll over me. Mr. Kaphar's drama, Exhibiting Forgiveness, which opens in theaters October 18th, is inspired by his own life. He wrote the script. It's the story of a famous painter who encounters his abusive father, a former drug addict, for the first time in 15 years. A reckoning is overdue. Andre Holland's performance as the artist unlocked something within Mr. Kaphar. As a child, he hadn't been allowed to cry. This was new. He reached out to Mr. Spielberg, a new mentor. He told me, I cried every day when I did my last film, The Fablemans. It was really, really encouraging. And it gave me so much hope in the process, says Mr. Kaphar, during a video call from his Connecticut home. Today, the filmmaker has many reasons to smile. The premiere for Exhibiting Forgiveness attracted attendees such as Serena Williams and Oprah Winfrey. Mr. Kaphar, a recipient of what's called the Genius Grant through the MacArthur Foundation, has had his paintings displayed at the Smithsonian's National Portrait Gallery in Washington. He has also launched an exhibition of artworks from the movie at the Gagosian Gallery in Beverly Hills, California. But critical acclaim for exhibiting forgiveness isn't as important to the director as his filmmaking journey. It transformed him. To tell the story, Mr. Kafar had to re-examine his interpretation of grievances he'd been holding on to. The visually sumptuous movie examines what it takes to pardon wrongdoing. You can pause the film at any moment, and it would be something that you could frame on the wall, says Alex Malice, whose unconventional 2022 documentary about Mr. Kafar, Shut Up and Paint, was also co-directed by its subject. It's not a surreal movie, but it has surreal emotion. You sort of tap into this feeling of empathy for who you see on screen, and you can't help but let a little bit of your own emotion seep in. And you see things you recognize, big and small, from your own life. It feels very specific, and yet somehow also universal. Before now, the artist's difficult childhood in a poor neighborhood of Kalamazoo, Michigan, hadn't figured into the biography of his prestigious rise. Famously, Mr. Kafar was in his mid-20s when he decided to become an artist. The Spark, a art history class in junior college, Mr. Kafar taught himself how to paint by visiting art museums. In 2001, he completed an MFA degree at Yale. He was awarded the Genius Grant in 2018. His most famous work, Behind the Myth of Benevolence, is a commentary on Thomas Jefferson's relationship with the enslaved woman, Sally Hemings. In response to the death of George Floyd and other black men killed by the police, Time magazine published Mr. Kafar's analogous colors on its cover. It depicts a mother holding a baby. The infant's silhouette has been cut out of the canvas, leaving a blank space within the outline of its shape. Yet for all the artist's success, he was secretly having panic attack nightmares about his father. "I would wake up just flailing and hitting the wall," says Mr. Kafar. "Scared me the moment when I woke up and put a hole in the wall. I realized how bad it really was." Mr. Kafar incorporated that detail into the movie. The protagonist, Terrell Roden, can't shake images of his father's drug use and violence toward his mother, Joyce, on Juwan Ellis Taylor. The movie itself, however, depicts those flashbacks with impressionistic techniques that create an impression of an assault without actually showing it. "I was not going to participate in a kind of gratuitous, salacious violence that I've seen in film after film, particularly domestic violence against women," says the director, who has sought filmmaking advice from supporters such as Mr. Spielberg and Spike Lee. "What we ultimately use is abstraction." In the movie, Terrell has a surprise reunion with his father, LaRon, John Earl Jelks, when he takes his wife, Andra Day, and his young son to visit his mother. Joyce implores her son to talk with LaRon. Terrell agrees to meet his father, but only if he can video the conversation. Many of those elements, too, were based on real-life events. "I went to his house, and I started filming him, which is, in fact, is more or less the scene that you see in the movie," says Mr. Kafar. "I made a documentary based on those recordings and felt very dissatisfied with it because it did a very good job of telling us where we were, but not how we got there." Mr. Kafar had long been promising his inquisitive children that one day he'd tell them the story of their grandfather. The artist waking up each day at 5 a.m. to write for 2 hours. The narrative about his life became a script. Revisiting those childhood memories conjured up images that inspired him to paint canvases that became part of the movie. "The thing that was the revelation is that my father is not the villain of my heritage," said Mr. Kafar, who left home to live with his relatives in California after witnessing his father commit a heinous act. "In my own head, I had set him up to be that." While completing the script, Mr. Kafar started writing and thinking from the perspective of LaRon, the father. Mr. Kafar realized that there are very few true villains in this world. Thinking back on his own childhood, in which he worked grueling and dangerous handyman jobs alongside his callous father, he recognized that his dad was trying to instill a work ethic to help him succeed in life. He's grateful for it. More importantly, Mr. Coffer now understands that his father loved him. I began to realize that my father is as much a victim as I was. My father suffered at the hands of his father, and in fact did better than his father, he says. That was difficult for me to accept initially, but by the time I got finished, it was just clear. It was absolutely clear. It meant that I have developed a new compassion and sympathy for my father. Mr. Coffer says that his father has begun a journey towards sobriety, but hasn't yet reached the destination. When his mother saw exhibiting forgiveness, it deepened their relationship through new mutual understanding. Like his proxy character in the movie, Mr. Coffer has let go of resentment towards his father. It had a healing effect. Since the film, I haven't had any more of those nightmares, says Mr. Coffer. I haven't had one for almost 2 years now, so I feel very happy about that. My wife is very happy about that. My contractor is not so happy about that. How AI deepfakes test voter confidence, election integrity. Artificial intelligence fraud has popped up in elections around the world this year, including America's upcoming presidential election. These deepfakes are often meant to amuse, but they also aim to sway elections, and sow division. By Laurent Belzy, staff writer. With more than 60 countries accounting for nearly half of the world's population holding elections, 2024 is turning out to be a record year for voting. Artificial intelligence threatens to undermine this democratic wave with audio and images that may look real but are fake. Often these AI deepfakes are meant purely to entertain, lampooning one candidate or another, but others are intended to sway elections, deepen political divisions, and diminish trust in democracy itself. Here's a look at what has happened so far and where the technology might be headed. The phenomenon first popped up in a big way in Slovakia's elections last fall. A deepfake video of an interview with pro-European leader Michael Šimečka presented him supposedly bragging about rigging the election and proposing to raise the price of beer. The manipulated audio went viral, and Mr. Šimečka's party, although leading in the polls, lost to the party led by pro-Russian Robert Fico. Since then, deepfakes have turned up in elections in Bangladesh, Nigeria, the United Kingdom, France, India, and elsewhere. In the United States presidential election, one of the first instances of manipulation to gain attention was a January robocall, ostensibly from President Joe Biden, urging Democrats not to vote in the New Hampshire primary. The prank's funder, a Democrat, said he did it as a warning that AI is a threat to elections. Since then, fake images have circulated depicting former President Donald Trump dancing with an underage girl, Vice President Kamala Harris wearing a communist uniform, and singer Taylor Swift endorsing Mr. Trump. Ms. Swift later endorsed Ms. Harris. How effective has the AI been? Not enough to sway elections, say researchers who have studied the issue, at least not yet. Even in Slovakia's case, some recent commentary has suggested that the factors behind Mr. Fico's victory may be broader than a simple deep fake. Warnings about AI aren't new. What has changed? Many nations are holding their first set of elections since tech company OpenAI released ChatGPT to the public in late November 2022. ChatGPT was the first widely available chatbot using generative AI. That's a technology that allows computers to process human questions with such a degree of certainty that they can generate answers that sound as if they're coming from a person. They can create not only realistic text, but also audio, still images, and video. Can computers now think? Well, not like people. Instead, they process so much material from the internet and elsewhere that they can predict the next word in a sentence with a high degree of accuracy, or conjure up an image that mimics human creativity, even if they're not conscious in the way people are. Do generative AI deepfakes differ from misinformation in previous elections? The difference is in the speed and volume of fake content generated. Deepfake videos in particular used to require expensive equipment, lots of expertise, and time. With generative AI, anyone can generate a fake video within minutes. They don't even have to film anything. They just describe what they want in words, and the computers generate a realistic video on the spot. This technological advance has led to surges of fake content around specified events. For example, the July assassination attempt against former President Trump inspired, in 3 days, as much election-related AI data as in all of May, says Emilio Ferrara, a computer science professor at the University of Southern California, who is tracking the technology's use in U.S. elections. Has the U.S. been inundated with deepfakes designed to sway voters? Strangely, no. I was worried that we'd be massively overwhelmed, says V.S. Subramanian, a computer scientist at Northwestern University, who in July set up a service to help journalists detect deepfakes. But we're not. In a newly released tracker of AI manipulation in elections, the German Marshall Fund lists fewer than 30 incidents involving the current U.S. presidential race. Instead, many of the deepfakes that have emerged are obvious parodies. Since spreading unsubstantial rumors about Haitian immigrants eating pets and wildfowl in an Ohio community, Mr. Trump has been depicted in various poses, saving cats and ducks. After President Biden dropped out of the race, doctored audio had Vice President Harris saying, "I, Kamala Harris, am your Democrat candidate for president because Joe Biden finally exposed his senility at the debate. Thanks, Joe." That doesn't mean a deluge of more malign deepfakes won't occur near Election Day, Warren Sui Liu, a computer science and engineering professor at the University of Buffalo. "But it's too early to call," he says. The infamous fake Slovak audio appeared 2 days before that country's parliamentary election. On the eve of Pakistan's elections in February, the main opposition candidate was falsely depicted urging his followers not to vote. Opponents of Mr. Trump or Ms. Harris may be holding their fire. In a new report, Professor Ferrara and his colleagues charge that a small but active number of users on the social platform X are coordinating activities and promoting one another's fake stories to attack the integrity of democratic processes. What about threats from overseas? Authoritarian governments such as China, Russia, and Iran appear to have adopted a similar focus. While they may try to influence particular races, their influence campaigns, including deepfakes, aim to promote political divisiveness in the U.S. and denigrate democracy as a solution to the world's problems. If you undermine the credibility of the biggest democracy in the world, then you are really undermining democracy at its core, Professor Ferrara says. Is the U.S. able to counter these AI-driven efforts? Researchers are heartened by the attention given to deepfakes in this election cycle, which should help voters become more discerning about assessing the reality of what they see and hear. The level of attention by federal and state officials has also soared. In an October 7th briefing with reporters, intelligence officials warned that foreign actors would likely try to sow doubt about voting results even after the election, especially if the races are close. The more officials see the potential impact, the more they're going to allocate resources toward countermeasures, says Professor Liu. "I'm cautiously optimistic." Calm amid climate change. The next climate summit will focus on peace. Some countries in conflict, caused in part by climate change, are already trying to achieve reconciliation between feuding groups, by the Monitor's editorial board. The world's next climate summit, which starts mid-November, will take a new twist. It aims to find both solutions for and adaptations to global warming by focusing on peacemaking. Climate change has fueled many conflicts, but in some places has also led to peace efforts to lessen its violent effects. Of the 15 countries most vulnerable to climate change, 13 are struggling with violent conflicts. To make the point about the summit's theme, host country Azerbaijan is considering whether to ask countries with conflicts to suspend hostilities during the 11-day conference. Similar requests have been made during the Olympics. One country in particular, in fact the world's youngest, is already trying to foster reconciliation between warring groups after record floods, heat waves, and droughts over recent years. South Sudan, which became independent from Sudan in 2011, has been in a civil conflict between two ethnic groups, with international mediators trying to resolve differences. But in addition, the adverse weather has driven clashes between farmers and nomadic cattle herders, forced to migrate into each other's lands and compete for resources. Some three-quarters of the African nation's 11 million people are in need of humanitarian assistance. In March, schools were closed for 2 weeks because of extreme heat. At the local level, many governors and civil society groups are bringing feuding clans to the table to negotiate an end to cattle theft and other abuses. Many of these peace initiatives are sponsored by the United Nations mission in South Sudan. Despite the difficult situation, people should strive for peaceful coexistence and unity, says Paul Ebweko, acting head of the organization's field office in Malakal. Some peace efforts are creative. UN peacekeepers from India, for example, bring warring clans together in the Greater Upper Nile by inviting them to bring in their cattle for checkups by Indian veterinarians. When we care for animals, we care for each other, which is a powerful catalyst for peace, says Lieutenant Colonel Manja Yadav, the deputy commander of the Indian Peacekeeping Battalion. The peacekeeper's motto, even in the darkest of times, the simplest acts of compassion and kindness can have a profound impact. For Global Climate Summit, with a theme of peace, that's also a good motto. The sound of silent giving. Generous donors who prefer anonymity may have many motives, such as humility. One study finds unobserved altruism can increase giving, by the Monitor's editorial board. Every year, starting at about this time, tens of thousands of American children mail a letter to Santa asking for a holiday present, often not for themselves. And ever since 1912, local post offices have invited people in selfless anonymity to fulfill those wishes by donating a requested gift. Known as Operation Santa, the program keeps expanding. 4 years ago, it went nationwide. This year, the U.S. Postal Service teamed up with Toys R Us to allow these secret donors, adopters, to easily buy the gifts online. This nurturing of generosity by strangers is akin to Toys for Tots, run by the U.S. Marine Corps Reserve, or the Angel Tree Program, run by the Salvation Army. They are bellwethers on how much people are willing to give without being identified. Call it kindness without kudos or pure love. In big money philanthropy, too, anonymous giving to either a cause or a group of people has gained more traction. Special consultants, such as one called Silent Donor, now advise wealthy people on how to keep donations private. In many cases, anonymous funders are simply humble enough not to seek credit and wise enough to allow recipients not to become beholden to them. Often a gift given under the radar encourages self-reliance. In the digital age, however, more donors want privacy to avoid solicitations or harassment by those opposed to a particular cause receiving money. The current climate of cultural divisiveness has transformed the act of donating into a public and oftentimes politicized spectacle, stated a 2022 report by the Philanthropy Roundtable. The Supreme Court has had to rule against those trying to trample on the freedoms of generous donors. Many religions make a case for anonymous giving. Maimonides, a 12th century Jewish scholar, ranked it high on his 8-rung ladder of types of giving. Jesus advised followers to give to needy people and do not announce it with trumpets. Pride in giving is seen as barely giving. Does anonymous giving inspire people to give? A 2019 study published in the Journal of Experimental Psychology Applied found that to be the case. Rates of unobserved altruism can often be higher than if the donation were to be publicly recognized. Donors may be confused about their motives if they anticipate or receive praise. The possibility of public recognition reduces donations by as much as 20%. The Postal Service's Operation Santa keeps mum on who donates holiday gifts to children, all the better as it helps to ensure such giving is from the heart. The from on the gift tag is nameless. That is to say, selfless. Thank you for joining us for the Christian Science Monitor Daily, read by Shari Mukundan.
The content featured in this recording may not reflect the views of AfterSight or the presenter. For questions, concerns, or editorial feedback regarding the Christian Science Monitor, please contact them directly at customerservice@csmonitor.com or call 617-450-2300 Monday through Friday.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.